today, the real April Fool is me. So, today I'm going to talk about a composer who, first of all, let me just state right off the bat, I am not fond of. I do not like him for many reasons. And I'm going to deconstruct one of his symphonies. And this man wrote a lot of symphonies. He wrote over 100. And so where better to start than his first one? So Haydn is often claimed to be extremely revolutionary as a composer. He has been called many names since he was alive, including Papa Haydn, gross, the father of the symphony, the father of the string quartet, the father of sonata form, maybe not the last one, but he is claimed for codifying the structures of a lot of things that we probably wouldn't be able to do without in music these days, especially chamber music. I have a lot of gripes about many of these things that they're claimed to be, namely that I don't think that he was necessarily the first to do them, and in fact he can't attribute anyone really to the success of one particular thing, because art just gradually shifts over time, you know? Some works are undoubtedly more important than others, but I'll get onto that later. But because I hate myself, I have decided to sit here late at night and deconstruct a 13-minute long Haydn symphony. This symphony was written in 1759, and it was Haydn's first composing residency job, so he wrote it with a specific orchestra in mind, of course. And while I was doing research, I tried to find where his inspirations lay, who he was, what he was composing for, what artistry he put into it. And what I found was that he composed this piece so that the Boccarellis would be impressed. You know the Boccarellis? You know the Boccarellis. The Boccarellis were, they were the guys who were like, you know, like an 8-bar structure. Feel like Haydn's not going to impress them with his distinct lack of 8-bar structures, but also, is that really the kind of person you want to impress? Who here can genuinely tell me that, is a Boccarelli minuet a good piece? It's fine. Is it something to aspire to? I guess if you're Haydn. Yeah, that's all there is to say about background information. There's really not much out there. Let's just start. So the interesting thing about this symphony is that it has 3 movements instead of 4, which is what Haydn would later codify. And I guess this is because this wasn't a totally original idea and was in fact based on the concertos and orchestral suites written in the years before. I know, shocking. Haydn had things he was working on. Okay, so the first movement, we have the exposition. One thing that I've heard was written about this particular exposition is that it features a Mannheim crescendo in the introduction. I would personally consider that to be a huge overstatement. Do you know why? Because all of the instruments are playing at the start, so it's not a textural build. It's just a crescendo. Also, Haydn tries to execute a crescendo in the first bar by having the 2 oboes both play a D natural in the lower register. If anyone here plays the oboe, they would know that playing quietly on the lower register of the instruments is extremely difficult. And, you know, coincidentally, a couple of weeks ago, it was actually something that I got called up on, and something that, yes, I did consider while I was writing it, but it seems like Haydn didn't. So that's interesting. Speaking of instrumentation, it's important to mention that this symphony consists of strings, two oboes, and two French horns in D. Now, Haydn is someone who has long stated to be responsible for inventing the structure and instrumentation of the orchestra. But this orchestra has a smaller instrumentation than certain pieces written by Bach. And like, you could make the argument that it's less important than, say, the Matthew Passion or stuff like that, but, you know, it's a symphonic work. It's written for a rich person. Dunno what you want from me there. Also, can I just say the melody is kind of confusing. So we have one cell, and then it's put a third above for the second bar, and then we have this entirely separate musical idea in the third and the fourth bars, and then we just kind of default to semiquavers, and it's like trying to be rhythmic diminution, but it's not really. It's just kind of having semiquavers there for the purpose of having semiquavers. Also, can I just say this entire time the oboe line is definitely just doubling. It's just doubling the violin lines, but less interesting. And then we get that for the rest of the movement as well. Like, I can think of exactly one instance in this piece where the oboes have anything interesting, which is just at the figure two mark. And even that nice bit of kind of imitation there, still doubling the violin section. The horns are just there for texture, I guess. But like, that's fine because it's extremely difficult to do anything on an actual horn anyway. And then we have the lower string parts, which is for the first three bars is D. They're D quavers, you know, just like the horn line. And then in the third bar, oh my goodness, the viola gets a G. Oh my goodness, it lasts for an entire minim as well. And then it goes to an F sharp before going back down to join in with what the cellos and the basses are doing. Wow. I bet every violist ever rejoiced at that point, except they very much didn't because they had a concerto at this point. Like, even Vivaldi viola lines were more interesting than this. Whenever I play Vivaldi concertos on the viola part, like, there's always something interesting going on. Like, in Winter, there's an actual solo line. Do we get that in this symphony? No. Also, we have, once again, the weird phrases with chord progressions that don't really make sense, mainly because they don't commit. Like, in the bar where they play in unison, we have this kind of fragmented idea of a B minor chord, but then it just immediately goes back into a unison D major arpeggio. And it's like, we could have had something interesting there, but instead it's just clumsy. It's just clumsy writing to not commit to an idea that you've presented. And that comes a lot quite often in this piece, honestly. It seems like every time a cell is established, we just immediately create a new one. Same with the harmony as well, like, especially in the development section, there's one specific bit where, like, the majority of the development section is in E minor, and it actually progresses to E minor in a pretty nice way, going through A major and then B minor, and then going from B minor to E minor, which is quite nice, actually, but then it just decides that we're in D major by playing a bunch of Ds in the violin line. It's like it's just, and like, you can't tell me that harmony used to work that way beforehand, because Bach literally invented equal temperament to make harmonization and modulation easier. So if anything, this is, like, regressive. No. Honestly, I think the biggest offender of this particular movement is the fact that it's just not an orchestral piece. Hear me out for a second. When I was listening to this the other day, I was watching the second violin parts, and the entire time I was thinking, that looks so fun. That looks like such a fun and interesting second violin line, especially in comparison to everything else. Like, just after the introduction, we get these phrases that mirror the first violin line in actually an extremely fun way. Like, it's kind of a rhythmic imitation thing, but it has a slight offset to it. Like, we have the second violin line playing the D major arpeggio, and then the first violin having the B to the G in quavers as well. And at the same time we have the second violin playing semi-quavers underneath that. Then we have the first violin continuing with the melody playing semi-quavers. And it's actually quite an interesting imitation that works really well harmonically. And as I was sitting there, frankly enjoying myself, I started to think, what would this piece be like if it was exclusively a violin duet? And then I thought, honestly, if anything, better, because you're not trying to find things to do with the other lines. I always think one of the biggest traps you can fall into with composition is just trying to find a use for every instrument, when honestly, you shouldn't be afraid to just kick an instrument out of your piece if you feel like it's not working. And in this case, it's all of the instruments except for these two parts, and everyone's like, oh, Haydn's such a good orchestrator. Well, what if he's just good at writing violin duets? Seriously, it's not a bad thing to be good at. Like, my first violin teacher once introduced me to this Haydn violin duet, which, from what I can remember, actually sounded quite nice. Maybe he's just better at working with two instruments than he is with multiple. And with that, let's go on to the second movement, which is a string quartet. You know how earlier I said that Haydn's also famous for establishing the string quartet? Well, this doesn't have oboe or horn, so it's essentially a string quartet. And can I just say before I start talking about this, how insane it must have been for audiences listening to just hear these four instruments played all at the same time. Nobody had ever composed for this set of instruments before. Nobody had ever written multiple concertos, or even, you know, specifically Concerto Grossi containing these specific instrument sets, and they certainly hadn't written more interesting parts than this one before. Just must have been a blessing. I'm so glad that Haydn invented this structure for us so that we can all play the string instruments at the same time. You know, what would they have even called us before we were the string instruments? They would have just said the violins and the violas and the cellos. They didn't even realize we all had strings. Anyway, the opening of this piece, I'll give it credit, is actually quite cute. It starts with a subject, then it has a kind of answer to it, then it has a variation of the first subject, and then the conclusion. And that's the first four bars. That's lovely, isn't it? That's all you need. That can't be that difficult, right? Right, Haydn? You're not gonna butcher this up for the rest of the piece, are you? You're totally not gonna follow this up with having what seems at first like some fun imitation between the second violins and the first violins again, but then just goes on to be this weird thing that exclusively consists of arpeggios and suspensions, because why would we have fun? And then obviously we have to play that same thing in unison, because why not just leave it? And then of course the first violin part, instead of playing a melody under said suspensions that the rest of the string section is doing, is just playing an E, but not just any E. It's not like a proper solid pedal or anything. It's also a syncopated pedal. You know, like, remember in Mozart's A Musical Joke where Mozart decided to have the viola section playing a random trill on the A string just for sillies? And he did this to specifically create a mockery of bad music at the time. You notice how this is a similar thing? Isn't that strange? Then we have another, again, relatively cute section. Honestly, all this does is make me think, is Haydn capable of better? Perhaps? But then why doesn't he do it all the time? Like, this is good imitation between the first and second violins. Most likely because it's much faster paced this time. Like, we have the triplets directly after one another instead of having there be three notes in the middle for no particular reason. The B section is also fairly solid, to be honest. It's pretty much just an antecedent consequent. Standard. Not impressive in any way, but standard. Phrasing definitely existed beforehand, by the way. I know, I play Telemann. I know phrasing. Then we have some more direct imitation with between the firsts and the seconds, and a bunch of repeated ideas once again, and then the piece is over. And you'll notice how I didn't mention the lower strings once. And again, it's because they're completely irrelevant. I thought chamber music was by definition supposed to be about playing together, and therefore is an excuse to really exploit the relationships you can find between all of these instruments. But apparently it's just supposed to be a relationship between two violinists and two third wheels who just sit and watch. You know, like, you know when you're watching a TV show and there are two side characters and then the main characters run onto the screen to have like a conversation with the side characters? And it's extremely obvious that said side characters were just standing still and not talking before the scene, and then the main characters leave the scene, and it's just, again, extremely clear that the side characters aren't going to speak ever again. And you just look at them and you think, I wonder if they know they're trapped inside a TV show. I wonder if they're aware of the nightmarish scenario of not being able to talk that they've got themselves in. Anyway, that's what it's like being a violist. Write good viola parts, please. The third movement is interesting because it's functionally a minuet and trio, but just doesn't have the trio. And honestly, that's genuinely interesting if we look at the development of the symphonic structure and we consider that the finale was the one to get added rather than the minuet and trio. Like, it makes sense, but yeah, it's just interesting. I just wanted to point that out. Just a brief hiatus from the snark. Not much to say about this particular movement other than just, he didn't even try with these oboe parts. Haydn, I know, would have loved the Control C, Control V function, because that is truly what this is for the oboe parts. Like, they're just outlining the chords, which defeats the purpose of elaborating on the chords in the first place. Like, you do realize this. When you write something that's based on a chord, but you've decorated it in your own way, having the chord be played as a straight chord underneath doesn't actually help the situation because we can all hear the chords there because it's a chord. And whenever the oboes aren't playing chords, they are literally just playing the violin melody and you won't be able to hear it anyway. Because there are more violins than there are oboes. Like, there are at least 4 violins in this scenario, I'd imagine, and there are 2 oboes. Violins definitely have a stronger projection in this scenario, and again, Haydn isn't having these instruments play in their lower register. One other thing to say about this particular movement is that a lot of it is revolved around this, like, trill from a D sharp to an E, which infuriates me. It genuinely does. It makes me angry because it's not connected to anything thematically, and it's based on a trill and it's based on a note that isn't really in any chord. Like, it's based on a accented passing note at best, and it gets repeated for like a solid 4 bars in a row and then again later on in the piece. And the reason why it makes me so angry isn't because of any of those reasons, but it's because everyone just dismisses it as Haydn having a little jokey joke. Because no, if I were to write this, everyone would hate me. They would look at it and they would say, "Amelia, why did you write that?" And I would say, "Why not?" And then they would say, "It doesn't make any thematical sense and or structural sense and or harmonic sense. And you could completely do without it. And it sounds really weird. And it sounds like somebody wrote that in by accident. So I just wanted to make sure if that was a deliberate choice you made to put that in." And I would say, "Yes, it was a deliberate choice." And they would still suggest an alternative to me. And I'm not saying that it's bad to offer an alternative to this. I'm saying that the original thing that Haydn wrote is bad, but he gets away with it because it's Haydn. And everyone just thinks of him as doing it for being funny. And it's like, I've never seen a piece where he doesn't do that. So maybe he's just not being funny and actually just not a good composer. To recap, this piece has weird phrasing. It has 2 instruments. It has melodies and sounds that refuse to be elaborated on as soon as they get interesting. And it's overall not at all an improvement. If I were to have a choice between playing this piece and, I don't know, Matthew Passion, I would choose Matthew Passion, despite the fact that it was written beforehand. And worst of all, it's written by someone who was considered revolutionary, so nobody would ever stop to consider if it is actually good. But oh well, I'm sure the Boccarellis liked it.